turns.
Oh, see, it goes on and off, so now it must be working. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
We get this little meter reading. To start with, today's December 14th, 1972. This interview is with Jim Clausen, a staff assistant to Ed Morgan on the Domestic Council. The interview is being held in room 167 of the old executive office building. The conversation is between Jim Clausen and Terry Good. All right, well, it puts on there the things that,
that you're going to have to find it to start with.
Right, so if anybody turns that tape on, at least we'll know at the beginning of it what it's all about. If you'll bear with me, I'll give you a little explanation of what we're doing, Jim, and why we're doing it. Our office is the one that's doing some of the work in terms of papers for the president's library. The oral history interview, the debriefing interview that we do, is for the purpose of, in many cases, just meeting the members of the staff, because we don't have that much exposure, we don't have that much contact with many of the people. We have found in discussions with previous with presidential libraries that not existed, a researcher will come in, or even members of the staff at the library itself will be going through the papers, and somebody's name will pop up in one of those papers, and they'll scratch their head and they'll say, gee, I wonder who that person was. Maybe the name will pop up somewhere else, and then they'll say, well, how come he's here, how come he's there, who was he, what did he do? This debriefing interview is an attempt to close that gap somewhat. We'll get some very basic information about you, and thereby perhaps satisfy any general inquiries that arise either from a staff member 20 years from now or a researcher who comes in.
Okay.
So we'll write a resume of this, send you a copy of it. You can edit it, modify it, add to it, whatever you wish. Mm-hmm. Send it back to us. We'll type up a final, send you a copy, and keep a final in our files.
That's correct.
And if there are any questions that I ask that touch upon matters that for any reason or other you feel are too sensitive to talk about, I'll be glad to turn the tape recorder off. If you want to talk about it to me, you can. I won't include them, just keep my own general knowledge.
Okay.
You know, I can stick back in the back of my mind and remember. Otherwise, we try our best not to get into areas that are sensitive. We're interested in administrative and organizational history and assignments. Mm-hmm. To the degree that they're not sensitive. Okay. When did you join, I don't know whether to say the Domestic Council staff or the White House staff, which would be best?
I'm going to go back. I suspect that the Domestic Council staff would be the best place to say, because that's where I have been closest to the president, per se. And that was in October of 1971. And that's when I began working as a staff assistant to Ed Morgan. Although I came to the executive office of the president, which is, I don't know if that's considered White House staff or not, as a member of the cabinet staff of the Cabinet Committee on Education in February of 1970. And that year I was involved in seven meetings with the president, having to do with our state advisory committees that were organized in that summer. But the Domestic Council is really the White House, the last year is the White House effort.
So actually you were within the executive office of the president beginning February 1970.
Right.
And then remained?
Yeah, and then actually remained. What happened is the Cabinet Committee on Education became a part of the Domestic Council. It wasn't before, but it was absorbed into the Domestic Council. And so they had hired me as the Domestic Council staff.
I would like to touch on this Cabinet Committee on Education, because I would assume that your involvement in that probably carried on to the degree that it continues.
Yeah, it still does right now.
All right.
In other words, and we're just going out of that business now.
Well, then maybe we better start with that.
Okay. Cool. Here's hanging down. So. Okay, well, this was, I'm not sure who originated the concept, because I, at the time, was not working at that level, but the Cabinet Committee was organized in February of 1970 with the Vice President as the Chairman and George Shultz as the Vice Chairman. The staff was composed of Bob Mardian as the Executive Director, and I guess, some other names that would come around, and I guess maybe names are helpful to you in all that you're doing.
Those that are
doing.
Significant in terms of your relationships and your contacts, as well as to more or less zero in on your position vis-a-vis everybody else.
Okay. Well, with that qualification, I would suspect that the people that were actually staff members on the committee at that time have all gone to other places, and none of them come from the White House. Right. Myself, my secretary, the only ones, I guess, who have really come this way. Bob Mardian, in November of that year, left to go to the Justice Department, and that's when Ed became executive director, Ed Morgan. And we became part of the domestic council and went on for, about 9 months until I became a member of the domestic council staff. That first year, the purpose of, this was 1970, the cabinet committee was to study and make recommendations on what the president ought to do or what kind of presidential policy there should be with regard to the school desegregation that was happening in the South. It was, action was probably precipitated, I say probably because again I don't know the entire decision-making process, but I know that that December, and so that would have been December 69, the Justice Department lost a Supreme Court case, Holmes versus Alexander, in Mississippi, that said that all the Mississippi school districts had to desegregate that February. It was a fairly traumatic experience. That was the years of the year of the campus unrest, the Kent State and Jackson State, which is in Jackson, Mississippi, also took place that spring. And so there was some very serious concern that with the turmoil that could ensue on school campuses, high school, and on down across the southern states, that there could be some very serious turmoil that summer and that fall, and wondered what could be done to ease that transition from these dual schools. And the president's directions were for this cabinet committee to study that, come up with any specific legislative proposals as well as any other thing that might help. They did, and I was not a party to the actual preparation of, but was involved peripherally because I had another assignment. But the what was now referred to as the Emergency School Assistance Program, ESAP, I guess is today's abbreviations of things. And the idea of giving financial aid to school districts was proposed and presented in March and May, both, I guess, two different pieces of that year. And at the same time, there was a decision made that there should be organized, voluntary, biracial committees, for lack of a better term, statewide in these states that were going to be affected, of people who would support public education and work towards getting community support for a smooth transition. I worked with Pat Gray, who was a consultant to the committee at that time, in traveling throughout the South and interviewing literally hundreds of people from all backgrounds, whether it be educators, professional people, bankers, whatever, men and women, who we thought could be of some help and get some feeling for what the needs are in a particular state. And then one by one, these committees were organized. The first one was the committee in Mississippi, and there were 16 members, and they were invited to Washington, where this was in June of 1970. They had lunch and met with the cabinet committee, which by this time was really being chaired by George Shultz. The vice president had other duties that, I guess he was almost titular in this whole thing, as much as anything else. And they met with the members of the cabinet committee and then with the president, went into the Oval Office. And the president spent about 30 minutes with him and talked to these people from Mississippi, indicating his concern and his appreciation of the voluntary effort and support and how necessary it was in making government go. In fact, as he met with all these committees, it was very, I think, eye-opening to me to listen to him talk, because he kind of gave insights to people about what his true beliefs were and his idea of local people solving and working on their own problems, and his idea of, I guess, that they have given his title of federalism, his new federalism. Mm-hmm. But it's the decentralization of the entire process. Anyway, starting with Mississippi through the various other states, Mississippi, Georgia, Arkansas, North and South Carolina, Alabama, and Louisiana. It culminated that summer in the president's trip to New Orleans in August, where he met with the Louisiana committee, and also he met with them in the morning, the afternoon, met with the co-chairman, in other words, the one black and white from each of the other committees, in the afternoon. And there was a lot of publicity for that, and this ties in with the parade, and it was one of his first trips to the South. And he spent, a good 4 hours that afternoon with these committee co-chairmen, discussing the various problems of the states and the kinds of things that he thought they could do and what they ought to be doing. And it was a good send-off that they spent that entire year, school year, the rest of that fall, entire school year. And we feel these committees were very helpful in running both publicity campaigns and solving problems that would arise and confrontations that would develop. They would get in behind the scenes and work with the various parties. And it opened up avenues of communication even between members of the committee themselves that they had never had before, which blacks and whites had never really sat around at that level on the table and discussed the problems of integration of the schools. And it was just generally a good year. And since that time, the president has not met personally with the committees, and that was the major year, although we've kept in touch. There have been letters and communications and things that have gone back and forth, and the cabinet members have, usually a couple of times a year, the most recent being the spring of this year, George Shultz and Elliot Richardson both met with representatives of these committees to discuss the progress and what's gone on and what's happened.
So the committees in these southern states have continued and still exist.
Yes, this year, because it was a political year, because most of the court cases and the desegregation effort had been in place for now two school years, the need for the committees was not as clear. The problems were working themselves out. The committees themselves, we've tried to keep pretty autonomous and let them decide some of their own things. The committee in South Carolina decided on its own to go completely out of business, and it did. Some of the other committees have gone on inactive status. Some of them have stayed in business. We did not fight that, but I guess at our level we could have said, the cabinet committee could have said, yeah, we want you to stay. But being a political year, and being these were people that weren't necessarily supporters of the president, I mean, they supported him in this particular effort, but they may not have necessarily been, nor did we want to make them be captive to him. We felt that that was their decision, whether they wanted to stay in business or not. And at this point, there's, I guess, two committees that are still, arguably have a couple of staff people on there doing some things, but most of them are on an inactive status, and the cabinet committee itself is just about to through. fact, with Ed Morgan's and my departure, that's going to be the end of the staff. So it will be a titular kind of thing. We're sending all of our files to them, wherever the files go. So I assume they eventually. These things talking about are all, there are news releases about each of these meetings with the president. And there's a great, there's a great deal of correspondence and record about it. So I don't know if that's your job to tie it all together or not.
Let me go back now. I feel as though I've got some sort of an outline, and what I want to do now is try and pinpoint your activities and connection with this. It was just you and Ed Morgan within that were pretty much full time, well, or perhaps just you full time on the Cabinet Committee on Education at this level, with Ed being the executive director, but also involved in many
other
things.
That's right. For the last 18 months, that's true. That's been the case.
So you're the person here who has day-to-day knowledge of what the Cabinet Committee on Education
is
doing.
All right. That's right.
You mentioned traveling with Pat Gray, who was a consultant to the committee, I take it, during that fall, was it?
Spring and summer of 1970.
Did you travel with him?
Yes. Yes. In other words, we traveled.
Just the two of you, then?
That's right.
All right. Were you down there for a day and then back?
No, most of the time we'd go on like 3 to 5 day trips, where we would, you know, do almost a whirlwind, meet with as many people on a day as we could, you know, from city to city, whether it meant flying, driving. On one occasion, or I guess I've more than one, on several occasions, I think of, you know, rent an airplane to make everything, you know, to get in on the schedule that we wanted to do, because we were working against a pretty stiff time constraint to get all the people talked to we went to. I think just the very fact that we did that as well was very helpful. The number of people that you would talk to, that you would go in and say, I can remember, for instance, John Peoples, who was the president of Jackson State College, we spent some time with, and the very fact that we were there as emissaries from the president, he felt was helpful, because it showed the concern at the highest level for what was happening in their cities.
Were you there to provide advice, or to simply be an ear of the president, to listen to their perspective?
Both. I think the latter being the bigger role, in other words, the being the ear and listening to what, in fact, we portrayed ourselves more at this level, saying, you tell us what the problems are and what you think. In fact, this is what the president had outlined eventually, what he wanted to be, is that oftentimes we sit in Washington in somewhat of ivory towers, and we think we know what's going on out there. You know, you read the newspaper or whatever else, and we don't listen what the people are saying. And it was very important to him that he know what those in the communities, particularly the community leaders, because they're the ones who were faced with the local decision-making problems, what they were faced with, not just elected officials, I mean, Chamber of Commerce people, and the school superintendents, and teachers, and principals, and anybody else. But at the same time, they would also say, you know, they would ask for advice about what we can and can't do. And we tried to describe some of the particular legislative proposal as well, and what we thought, what advice we could give, and what we thought to some of the things that were available to them that they could do in terms of getting assistance from the federal government.
Is your background law?
Yes, I'm a lawyer from Southern California.
Was education something that you have been involved in?
No. But as oftentimes happens in Washington, the reason I got there is because I was an assistant to Bob Mardian, who was general counsel at HEW. And so when he took the position as executive director of the committee, I went with him. And so it just developed out of assignment more than any background on my part. Although it was not new to me, I had served on some school board committees in the city that I was in, which I was familiar with a lot of education problems, although not trained academically in any education.
In the course of these meetings that you had with these people on this particular trip, did you have the time to follow up these meetings with, let's say, just resumes of the meeting, the discussions that transpired? Would that be found in your files?
Yes. So trip reports were filed on every one of the trips. In other words, and everybody, we would go down just to like a paragraph. We met with so-and-so who did such-and-such, and here's what he said. And so you'd get a whole cross-section of feeling from people. And those are all in the files by state, and they're called trip reports. It's kind of almost a methodical itinerary that's fleshed out with the people that we met with.
Following that trip, then, you came back, and at that point, those committees had not been...
Well, we'd do Mississippi, travel all around Mississippi, then come back and recommend who we thought should be on the Mississippi committee. The appointments were made, and we then went on to another state, while other members of the staff here would begin organizing the coming of the trip to Washington, the meetings here, and the meeting with the president. So it was kind of all going at once. For example, the time that they came to Washington and their meeting in June, we were working in Georgia as well, getting the Georgia committee. And so in July, at one point we were running like once a week we'd have a group that would be up here. And we've been, you know, just kind of building up to meeting with people. And so we just get the committee put together and then have come to Washington. I don't know if you follow all that.
Yes,
it was all happening
yes.
at the same time.
Okay, we've set up the committees. They've come to Washington initially. They've had their first meeting up here, and then they go back to their respective states. And from that point on, then you're in constant communication.
Yes, that was my major role, and I guess this is why I stayed and why I've been here, was the liaison person with those people. So we were in constant communication. For instance, the North, that was the fall of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg busing case. They had to implement in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. They had gone to the Supreme Court with a request for a stay. There was a great deal of trouble, and it was the type of thing that I was in, you know, and I was in daily, almost constant communication with members of the North Carolina Committee who were very concerned, and they had a lot of meetings that were going on in Charlotte-Mecklenburg as well as other places around, but they would, you know, try and get the various factions together and the groups that would get together and say they were going to have some big boycott or they were going to do this or do that. They would try and meet with them, and we'd provide whatever assistance either through the Justice Department. And we were talking to the Attorney General, who was on the committee, which we could go back to us to, and we arranged for a meeting with the Solicitor General, I remember that fall, because the request was that they knew that the federal government would be, you know, would file a brief and would be in the case. The people, the school board, wanted to have their feelings, in other words, they wanted someone to hear, in other words, wanted their feelings known of what they thought should be the government's position. So we arranged for them to, you know, to meet with the Solicitor General, who was going to be arguing the case, which was done. So those were kind of some of the kind of things. It was, you know, really a day-to-day, staying in constant touch with them.
This relationship that you had with these various committees, I'm just talking off the top of my head, so bear with me on this. Was it a case of you were more or less equal with them in this, and that you were trying to assist them in Washington while they were working the local problem there, or did they look to you, up to you, so to speak, for some sort of high government advice and guidance?
I think it depended on the particular individual on the committee. A lot, you know, the kind of relationship I developed with them. I think it was both. There were a lot, and particularly, and I say this advisedly, but those who had been in the past fairly unsophisticated about ways of Washington would do the latter. In other words, they would look to you know, I mean, the phone call to Jim Clausen at the Cabinet Committee was, you know, a phone call to the President, and it was almost like, you know, here's our problem, and I'm sure you can, you know, you can just snap your fingers and it will all go away. And there were others who certainly, I guess an example would be some of the particular people, Arthur Tonsmeyer's one, and Archie Davis, who have been on the national scene, both of them presidents, past presidents of major association, one the American Banking Association, the other the National Savings and Loan Association, so had done a lot of business in Washington. They knew how, you know, government worked and knew what went on, and we had just almost an equal break, you know, they understood the problems, and it was more the former, what you said.
Yeah.
So it depended on the particular individual that that you would talk to.
And the role of these committees in these states was just to try and avoid these confrontations, these big blow-ups, try and iron out the problems, get people to talk.
That's right.
To each other.
That's right. It wasn't a matter of the committees were, and they all agreed. The only reason we got, the only way we were able to get the great cross-section of people to serve that we did, from, you know, if I can use the liberal to conservative definitions, which are very poor, but if I use them, it was from both extremes, from, you know, the militant black to the, you know, redneck, you know, white, serving on the committee, because the understanding was, and we all agreed to that, the ground rule was, there was going to be no position taken on, as to whether or not a particular plan for desegregation was good or bad. That wasn't the point. The point was, if, you know, given the situation that we have, we cannot afford to have the public school system destroyed and people and property destroyed. And now, when I say destroyed, I don't mean necessarily by violence, burning it down, physical. I mean, whether it may be just white flight, it may be just poor education, because everything is so disrupted, with whether it be just fears on the part of people that they're picketing and all of the other kinds of things, that children aren't being educated, or the children themselves are not interacting and are not being educated, or that the, in the white flight problem, which is a serious problem, still is, that all the people leave the, you know, the white normally, and normally more affluent classes, because they're the ones who can afford to put them in private schools, leave. Work against bond elections and what have you, the general tax base, and support, public support financially for the schools deteriorates to the point where what's left is a very poor education system, which it's a bad circle. You know, ends up with then industry doesn't want to be there, and other people leave, and you'll end up with a section of the country in fairly poor condition. We think that you know, we weren't doomsayers. That this was going to happen, but that anything that could be done to prevent it, no matter what, in other words, I can't put my finger on it and say, well, that would have happened were it not for these committees. I mean, that's not true. In fact, I don't believe that. In hindsight now, I think the country would have muddled through that, as I think it will, the things that are happening in the North, and the same kinds of problems that are beginning to happen other places in the country. I think we're the kind of people who will eventually make it. But there's nothing wrong with greasing the thing a little bit and making it a little bit easier. And I think the committees helped that.
Which one of the committees did you probably devote as much time and attention to as any of the others? Or was it pretty well equally distributed?
Oh, I would say it's pretty well equally distributed, except that I think the Louisiana committee got less than any of the others. I would have to go the other way. I would say everybody's about equal. Louisiana got less. It was the last to be formed. I personally did not have, I had very little to do with its formation. There were a couple other people who did that one, so I didn't know the people very well. The people themselves in Louisiana, they had previously, under Governor McKeith in the year before, had a statewide committee that had done a similar function. And so there was some feeling on their part that their role was not as necessary, so there wasn't as much, you know, going on, so to speak. So I didn't have that much to do with them, although I still, I know a lot of them well, still do business with them.
I'm going to ask you one question that you may not answer if you don't wish to. It's one that just came to mind. It seems to me at that time when these were being formed, there was some, I guess I might say, controversy within some of these southern states by some of the state governments or governors that this was an intrusion upon their special domain.
That's right. It's most of the governors, well, all of the governors where the committees were held were contacted by the Office of Intergovernmental Relations and had been discussed with them the concept of this being done. None of them said no, but we were met with a very mixed reaction, from coolness to some antagonism to some great support from governors.
You probably expected that, at least.
Yes. Lester Maddox was governor in Georgia at the time, and he was less than happy with our being there.
Did you encounter that same mood, let's say, at the levels that you were having to work at, even outside of the state governments? Did the local man on the street, perhaps, in many instances, look upon you as
sure.
Carpetbaggers?
Sure. Well, no matter how you came, we were still federal officials, you know, coming from the north, and how, you know, we were met with great suspicion. Both sides. It wasn't, you know, a lot of people say, well, it'll just be the whites who do it because we were there to try and make something happen, you know, drive something down their throat. No, the blacks were just as suspicious because they could interpret it as being we were there to keep it from happening. You know? And so anybody who, I think maybe rightfully so, I learned a great deal my experience in the South. They have traditionally been somewhat put upon by federal whatevers. I'm not going to say rightly or wrongly, but either, you know, the revenuers and
yeah.
or whatever else, that, you know, anybody from Washington was a threat to them until they got to know them and realized that we were there to cooperate. We weren't there to, you know, knock anybody in the head to do any particular thing. It was, we're here with our, you know, kind of a hand of fellowship, so to speak, to provide whatever assistance that you think we can provide. And that varied from state to state. And we made that very clear, that what you people are the leaders in the state, what you think the federal government ought to be doing in your state in this issue may be different from what goes on, you know, in Arkansas. North Carolina is different than Arkansas. A lot of people like to lump them together, but North Carolina is a very industrial state with a great deal different makeup than Arkansas has, and their needs are different, and so we do different things.
Based upon what you just said, I would have to assume, as just an objective viewer of this, that the very existence or creation of these various committees in these states then represented a tremendous step forward, a sign of success on your part, in terms of just going down there and setting
That's
up
right.
the committees, given this...
Given the problem that we had to face, the very fact that they were organized and came into existence was a major accomplishment. I think that's absolutely correct. There are a tremendous number of people who thought that it could just never be done, or the only way it could be done would be for us to do it politically. Mm-hmm. We would just go to the Republican Party, ask the party to identify those people who would support the president. Well, we saw that as meaning you would get probably a pretty good section of the white population, and all you'd get from the black community would be, frankly, by his name, Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
Which would be absolutely meaningless for what we had to do. And so we opted not to do it that way, and to go the kind of the hard, back-breaking route of just personally talking to everybody and let them know who we were and why we were there and what the president wanted done. And not only the government, this also ruffled the feathers, and I don't mind saying at this point, of some of the party people. State chairmen were not particularly happy, as, you know, governors were not happy with doing it this way, neither were some of the party people. They thought that, you know, this was another thing that was a part of our patronage system and that we should be giving it to Republicans. And And once, though, it was that, you know, we were able to spend some time with them and identify the concept of what we were doing, most of them all came around and all understood that it was not the kind of thing that falls out and is identifiable on party lines or necessarily, you know, sort of.
Did you have much contact or conflict with, let's say, regional offices of, let's say, HEW? I'm just using that as an example. Were there offices of HEW in these various states that were doing something similar to what you were doing? Or?
No. No, they don't remember doing something similar. We coordinated all this through the agencies. The Finch and Richardson were both on the committee. Mitchell was on the committee. The closest thing to what we were doing, I guess you could say, would be in the Justice Department, their Community Relations Office. Is an ongoing program of, firefighting. It's kind of a mediation service that goes into troubled areas, whatever. It doesn't necessarily have to be, it isn't just schools or so forth. It's any place where there may be a conflict. I mean, the FBI or whatever might identify as this is potentially a troublesome thing. And they'll go in and try and get the various sides together behind the scenes talking to each other. It's a very non-visible program. I don't think most people even know that the Relations Service exists. And they want it that way for obvious reasons. And that's the closest thing to what we were doing.
Did you work with them?
Yeah, very much so. I had quite a few meetings with their staff people, and they helped us identify. In other words, we would use whatever source we could, including regional offices of the various agencies, to help us identify who the people were. And who are people that we should talk to in the various communities. And that's
were these officials of the federal government receptive to you and quite cooperative?
By and large, that they were. Where we got into problems with the federal officials was later on when the money became available and HEW got into the business of making grants to school districts. I think for obvious reasons, became very jealous of their power to decide who gets money and who doesn't. And they didn't like the local newspaper editor, who happened to be on our committee, telling them that the money wasn't needed for this or it was needed for such and so.
These committees had that type of...
They didn't have, actually, they had input.
Advisory?
Advisory. They certainly had no veto power and they couldn't make it happen. But our problems came, in other words, the rub would come. Let's say it came later on when somebody would, you know, when they'd try and say, well, you know, we don't think you ought to be doing that here, and we'd have to push and shove and do a little other stuff. Right. They were very helpful in that regard as well.
Were there occasions where one of these committees might take a position that you didn't tend to agree with up here, and if so, how did you resolve those? Was it a case of kind of twisting the arms a little bit and saying, we think that perhaps we have better insight on this than you do, or?
Oh, yeah, I think we've, you know, both sides would say, and if you talk to them, they won some and lost some. We won some and lost some. As you might gather, that they might come in and say, we think there ought to be, you know, X amount of dollars to do such and so. And we may be constrained either by dollars or we may be constrained just in terms of priorities and say, well, you know, in this program, here's what we were really trying to do. So we respect your judgment. And I think you're probably right with what you're saying, but we still want to go ahead and do it this way because from our perspective, here's what we want to do. Most of the times, the ones that they would win would be cases where they would say, we don't think that needs to be done here. Whatever it might be. In other words, they'd come in and say, well, I don't think you ought to be funding, you know, so-and-so to do such and such. And if we, you know, and we wouldn't just solely take their word, I think it's a good worker answer, when a lot of times we'd find out they were right. That the particular organization or the particular thing the school district wanted to do was something that the federal government hadn't ought to be doing. And so they were very helpful. In that regard.
By and large, will most of this be pretty well documented, Jim?
Oh, a lot of it would be. A tremendous amount of it happens over the phone.
As is always the
case. And so you're not going to, you know, and I am not one who sat down and dictated notes to the file about everything that happens, particularly in, you know, when things are, there's a lot of it and there's lots happening while I just did by time constraints wasn't able to do it. All of that that it was on paper, certainly, is in the file and is there for anybody to see. You know, we have nothing to hide because I see the role somewhat as an ombudsman type of role even. Where people would write up and say, you know, such and such is on it. Another thing that was very good, and people can never believe this when I tell them, that was provided, was became very helpful, it provided an avenue for the grantees or the school districts, and there were also private nonprofit groups that were also funded under this program. PTAs, civil rights groups, and others, they also got money.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's called the community groups. And the thing that there were lots of other people who got money to help. But is that in the grant process, there would be money that would they'd apply for, you know, an application would go and be looking for money, and they'd never hear anything, and they'd fight the bureaucracy, and they'd never get any answer, and you would find out things like they just got stuck on somebody's desk, or they'd lose them. You know, I mean, there's. You'd be surprised in this government how little access people have to find out what happens to them. And I'm sure this is not just this one program. This is true everywhere. It's like the Social Security checks. And I know I've listened to people who argue about, you know, trying to get something changed or they don't get their check and trying to get things changed. You know, and then there's no place for them to go. And this happened to provide a place for them to go that had access through members of our committee directly to the cabinet. So you could, you know, you could get immediate response. It's unfortunate that there has to be such a thing, but it provided a very valuable service at a time when tensions were kind of high anyway, and people were kind of uptight about what was happening.
You were a bellwether, you were a fireman, an ombudsman, any of those terms would apply.
Any of those terms would apply, that's right.
I've already asked this question before, but your answer has kind of slipped my mind. In terms of the amount of time spent in Washington versus time spent in these southern states, any general estimate?
Yeah, I would suspect that over the long haul, about 20% of my time was spent out in the field. Other than one day a week. Talking about a 5-day week, I would expect at least one day a week I was out. My wife would probably tell you more than that. I seem to be gone a lot, but there are times, you know, where I'm here for, you know, a month and a half and not go anywhere at all, and then I'll be gone for, you know, a couple of weeks. So I think I got to figure about 20% of my time is spent traveling.
How were these particular states selected? I noticed the Florida is not there, Virginia is not there, Tennessee, Kentucky is not there.
Yeah, that was a decision that I was not privy to. I have surmised that it was based upon some computation of numbers of school districts that were going to be required to be making a change. I think arguably we could have had in the ensuing year Tennessee and Virginia, but that particular year those states were not undergoing, in other words, the Nashville and Memphis and those states, they're all just happening now, in fact. And the decision was made not to have more committees. There was a lot of push and pulling, I'll be honest to say, that we should have gone on. That was all I was physically able to do that year, but there was some that said we should have continued on and done eventually all 50 states because they saw it coming, or at least all of those states where there's going to be where they have a sufficient number of minorities that there could be you know, desegregation taking place. And I had mixed emotions about that, pro and con. As one who was involved from the beginning, so I said, I think it would be a good idea, but just not with me. You know, I'm not prepared to go to Michigan and talk to, you know, I mean, it's a very tough, time-consuming and expensive in the sense that it's a lot of manpower. I think that the overall budget of the cabinet committee was exceptionally small for that was accomplished. I think in the 3 years we've been in business, we've probably spent less than $500,000 for everything. For all of that, sounds like a lot, which is, in my opinion, a major accomplishment. But there's a lot of other hidden factors that get involved in it. Now that as I go on, I don't know how I'm going to get out from under all the content, all the people that I have now who call me. You know, I may be an ombudsman for the rest of my life.
Well, this is one of the questions I was going to ask, given the flare-ups in Richmond, Detroit, Prince George's County.
Yeah, I've spent, Prince George's County, I spent a tremendous amount of time on the phone right now just talking with people about that. And I say it's a very time-consuming thing.
Well, that, again, seems to indicate to me that regardless of how you viewed the outcome of your activities in the South, obviously other people in other states around must have gotten word that you're...
And wanted them. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Both, all the states that you mentioned, Florida, Virginia, and Tennessee, all would like to have been at least, all specifically requested saying.
At this point in the interview, Mr. Clausen was called away for a meeting. It was decided that we would attempt to reschedule the conversation for a later day.